Wednesday, November 9, 2016, and this is KBIA's Views of the News. Our weekly roundtable on media behaviors comes to you from the Futures Lab studio at the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Amy Simons, and here with me are my colleagues, Mike McKean and Ernest Perry. We're going to throw out our normal show format this week, and we're just going to talk. We're going to talk about what happened yesterday, how the media covered it, and what we think life's going to look like for the media, for the American people, for all of us for the next 4 years. So let me start by asking you, what happened yesterday? Maybe that election wasn't so rigged.
Well, and I'm going to answer it from a media frame. I'm going to say, you know, here's what the news media need to be saying to the American public this morning. We're sorry. We failed you. The pollsters we quoted got it wrong. The reporters got it wrong. The editors got it wrong. Professors and experts got it wrong. Everybody that we quoted got it wrong. And I think that it behooves us as journalists to figure out what we need to do to do better.
Well, I think one of the things that we need to do to be better as journalists is to actually talk to people. We fell into the trap that we fell into in 2000. That we said we were going to get away from, and we fell right back into it in this election, and that's covering it like a horse race. Every time we get into these kinds of elections where you see the public, and when I say the public, I'm talking about the public that usually doesn't turn out, usually doesn't engage, instead of us moving to that public to say, hey, you know, what are your issues? What are you concerned about? What's going on? Instead of doing that, we stick to what we know, which is the horse race method of covering it. And it's the polls, and it's the sort of back and forth, and it becomes about the candidates and not about the people who the candidates are trying to reach.
Yeah, I'll say too, I mean, I think that, and I'm not trying to make light of this, but we talked the past couple of weeks about this sort of thesis I have that journalists need to be able to walk and chew gum at the same time, not frame stories too simplistically. Well, I think maybe, and I will give the media credit so far, and maybe it's just because they're all just so shocked that they haven't come up with a simple narrative yet. I hope we won't, because this isn't a simple narrative as to what happened yesterday. We have to walk and chew gum and juggle knives and walk down the road in the dark all at the same time, maybe, because there's a lot of different things we're going to have to try to explain and stories we're going to have to cover with some sophistication, which we're not, frankly, as a group, used to doing very well.
And we just don't do it very well. I mean, to me, I think part of it is that we sort of talk in this echo chamber. Mm-hmm. And I think we've spent a lot of time in the echo chamber, especially because of the impact of social media on this race in particular. I mean, Mike and I just left a conversation and a talk by someone who's really good at data journalism. And one of the things that she brought up was, you know, basically we sort of look at the tweets, but we aren't talking about why is this person tweeting this way or how do you make that connection? And one of the things that she brought up, which I thought was insightful. And she said, Donald Trump used social media the way everyday normal people use social media, and not the way that journalists use social media, or the way that academics use social media, or elites use social media. He uses it the way that normal people use it, which in many cases is crude, it's uncivil, it's direct, but it connects. And I think that was one of the things that this election showed.
Is it presidential? Is that something you think that we're going to continue to see that strategy in how the future POTUS using social?
But I think presidential has been redefined.
Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
I would say, too, because I think the social media piece of this is just is one of many factors we should talk about. But I would agree. You know, I sat in on the same conversation from this scholar from UT talking about social media and Trump's strategy. I think she was right about that Trump used social media the way normal people use social media, but also in a very sophisticated way. If you look at how journalists covered Trump's use of social media, it was almost all about how he shoots from the hip, that it's hurting him, the 3 a.m. tweets about Alicia Machado, or, you know,
the retweets of certain
Right.
Factions.
The New York Times long and funny and awful list of all the people he insulted, you know, along the way on Twitter. Okay, all that is true. But who covered, other than the story you surfaced for us, I think, last week on the show from Business Week, where they talked about this very sophisticated shop they had set up in San Antonio that had a suppression strategy, that had a battleground state social media and big data strategy, that Trump people maybe were not as stupid, at least from that technical standpoint, as the media painted them to be.
So let's back up for a minute and talk about polling, about, you know, the upshot from the New York Times, about Nate Silver and 538 and these predictions that at one point had it you know, Hillary Clinton with a 93% chance of winning this thing. Right. New York Times scaling it back to the low 80s as polls were opening yesterday morning. And then, you know, it just, that wasn't what happened. The polls were just wrong.
No, they were flat wrong. And I think what they're starting to realize is that wherever they were getting their polling data, whoever they were polling, either they were polling the wrong people or the people that they were polling weren't telling them the truth. And I think it may be a combination of both. I think that there are large swaths of the American public that they went after in terms of the polls that were not telling them what they were really going to do for a whole host of reasons. And that played out yesterday when you start looking at the election returns coming in. But I also think that in our ability to poll, or the ability of these pollsters to get this information, mm-hmm. they're missing people because of robocalls, because of cell phone use, and the fact that you have a hard time getting those cell phone numbers.
Yeah.
All of those things, I think, factored into why these polls were just completely off.
This is just another example, the Brexit situation and the polling around that. I mean, The scientists who do public opinion polling, they know how much harder it is to do now. They know that they have to do all kinds of sophisticated weighting and modeling to try to represent the public, you know, in ways that they can't because of cell phones and other stuff. Okay, that's part of it. I think another part of it is that whoever was trying to predict what the turnout was going to be for this election, and who was going to turn out, got it wrong. I don't know why. There's going to have to be a lot of analysis, but some early numbers showed that there was a 5% increase in the turnout nationally, and I imagine that that 5% was not evenly distributed either. I mean, a lot of it was from people, perhaps, you know, I don't know what the motive is, Ernest, but I think a lot of people probably didn't tell pollsters, if they were contacted, how they were actually going to vote. They might have thought that it wouldn't be perceived as being socially correct or whatever their answers, but there are a lot of folks who turned out that weren't accounted for, and their direction of their vote wasn't accounted for.
But I also think you had a sort of a 2008 effect too, whereas in 2008 you had a lot of people who normally would not vote and probably haven't voted since who came out to vote for Barack Obama.
Mm-hmm.
I think you had that same effect here, that maybe part of that 5% you're talking about, who first time they'd ever voted, probably will never vote again, they came out and voted yesterday, and they weren't factored into all the prognostication
so
that was going on.
So you raise an interesting point, and I want to talk a little bit about millennials and how they factored into this polling, but you bring up Barack Obama in 2008, and how in 2008, Barack Obama's use of social media was considered to be groundbreaking and revolutionary at the time, because it had never really been done before. Let's think about how social media has changed between 2008 and today. In 2008, it was those millennials who are now approaching, you know, voting for the first time, who were 18, 19, 20 years old. They're now starting to push 30. And platforms like Facebook and Twitter are growing in popularity with their parents and their grandparents, who are on social media platforms, frankly, to keep in touch with their children, right? Their children and their grandchildren. And we saw Donald Trump reach that generation on social media in that way. One of the things with polling that had been kind of acknowledged from the beginning was the wild card of how millennials were going to factor into that, because in part, not having landlines, right? And they become underrepresented in polls. And Bram Sablesmith posted something fascinating on Facebook, kind of thinking about this. And I want to put the question to the two of you about millennials and how many of them who maybe had in the past lived in smaller or medium-sized cities, the Milwaukees, the St. Louises, the Kansas Cities, the Detroits, the Minneapolises, who have moved to New York and Seattle and San Francisco and Chicago because of the changing job market and the access to quality of life things? And how might those moves have also affected this?
I think they could have. I think another really interesting question for me is, I mean, we assume that millennials have a lot in common mm-hmm. with a certain more progressive, you know, wing of the Democratic Party, and that may or may not be true. But they also are perhaps the first generation, globally speaking, who worry that they're going to be less well off than their parents were. And, you know, Bernie Sanders tapped into that. Donald Trump may have tapped into it more than we think, or he may have suppressed those folks who thought yeah. he wasn't the right answer to
no,
the problem.
No, I think you're absolutely right. I do agree with you. I think that generation has moved to those areas, both for economic reasons as well as for quality of life mm-hmm. reasons. Okay, and I think you're going to see even more of that over the next couple of years because they sort of move to areas where they're like-minded people are and like culture, shall we say. But I also wonder whether or not millennials actually could connect to either one of these candidates. And the Bernie Sanders, and Mike, you sort of brought this up a couple of weeks ago, the Bernie Sanders contingent said, we're not going to vote for her. And I think that happened yesterday. They said they weren't going to do it, and they didn't do it. Trump's people from the beginning said, we don't care what you come up with on Trump. You can talk about his misogyny. You can talk about his racism. You can talk about all the money that he has or don't have. You can talk about the fact that he didn't release his tax returns. We don't care because we're going to vote for him because this is a vote against the establishment. We want to blow it up. And they did what they said.
And that was something that was actually on 60 Minutes the other night, that they did a focus group on a segment on 60 Minutes Sunday night where they asked how many people in this group, I think of like 20 people, were voting for a candidate and three people raised their hand. How many of you are voting to vote against a candidate in the entire rest of the room?
But here's the thing. To me, every news organization should have been watching that and saying, whoa, wait a minute. This election could go another way because they're not talking about the candidates. Mm-hmm. They're talking about something totally different. And it all boiled down to it. I was watching this last night, especially on CNN. They did a pretty good job of going back and forth from the map showing the percentage of where the votes were going to their focus groups and their exit polls, which talked about what was the biggest issue. And the biggest issue in every one of those races that was tight was the economy. It went back to the economy, and it had very little to do with Donald Trump himself, but the message that he was putting out there.
The problem, of course, and we have to be very humble about this today, is that those exit polls also were predicting earlier in the day. I mean, the news organizations and the candidates had access to them, and they were predicting that Hillary Clinton was going to win. So I'm not sure all the data from those exit polls should be trusted either. And there also was a sense from one slice of that data I saw today where, surprisingly enough, many people who voted did say that they were enthusiastic about the candidate they were voting for, which runs completely contrary to what that focus group on 60 Minutes showed and to the kind of the assumptions the media had that this was two bad candidates, a choice of the lesser of two evils.
Yeah, and that's the other part of the whole media narrative that really bothered me. And this began bothering me about a month ago, mm-hmm. the whole thing about the lesser of two evils. You kept hearing that over and over again. That became the narrative that the media spun out there, is that the public is choosing between the best of two evils. And when you look at what happened last night, I mean, does the result say that Hillary was the worst and Donald Trump was the best of two evils? I mean, nobody's saying that now. Nobody's talking about it. But that's been the narrative for the last 2 months, especially since Labor Day.
And it's not that any one of these simple narratives that we concocted over the time are necessarily wrong. It's just that we put too much focus on any one of them. I was just running through a list of some of the narratives that either have been used or that might be used to explain what happened. I came up with like 17 different things that journalists could talk about, but they never talk about them, you know, in relationship to each other, one at a time. Okay, was it the FBI? Was it WikiLeaks? You know, was it, you know, the biased media? Was it, you know, sexism or racism or nativism? Or was it that young people didn't show up? Or, you know, the third party candidates somehow took away votes from Hillary Clinton? I mean, there's a whole bunch of of potential explanations, and we need to spend time digging into each one of them more subtly rather than just throwing one of them up there on the screen and talking about it all day and then moving on to the next thing.
But there's one issue that I think we do need to talk about, and we began talking about this on the show almost 2 years ago, and that's inequality. Mm-hmm. And that is one of the things that has sort of permeated this campaign from both parties since the beginning, 15, 16 months ago, is there is a large segment of the population that feels as if they are left behind and that they were crushed in 2008. Some of them have come back, but not nearly to where they were. You have others who lost a job but found a job at a lower pay, okay, and are worried about whether or not they may be able to keep that job. Mm-hmm. And you see it across the spectrum. And the two candidates that I'm going to talk about, Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders, figured that out and they used it. Donald Trump used it all the way to the White House. Bernie Sanders tried, but because Hillary Clinton had built such a base, he wasn't able to do it. But that issue is still there. It is still resonating. And now it's Donald Trump's responsibility to deal with inequality. And his window is going to be short in dealing with that. The question becomes, how will the media handle covering him trying to deal with it? Are they going to do it the same way that they covered Barack Obama and the Republican Congress, which is this sort of backbiting, infighting kind of coverage? Or are they going to actually begin to cover that issue from where people live in their lived experiences?
I agree with that completely, and we've talked about that a lot. So I think, you know, I'm just going to let what Ernest said stand on that. And that's one of the issues that journalists need to cover going forward. And I just think we need a lot more explanatory journalism on several different things. I mean, what do we mean by saying repealing and replacing Obamacare? What does that mean going forward? I mean, what about the Supreme Court? Why is that an important subject going forward? How's that going to work? You know, the Republicans theoretically have a unified government now, first time since, what, the Herbert Hoover's days or whatever, long time ago. What does that mean? Is Trump going to pivot on immigration? What would that look like if he's really going to be? There's so many stories where we need to dig in and not just put up a quick headline and quote a few people from each side, and oh, by the way, can we get rid of the excess of pundits on TV?
Oh, yes, please. For the love of God, let's get rid of
that. Talk a little bit about that, because yesterday, I will admit, I was very wrapped up myself in an election coverage project that I was working on, so I didn't get to watch a whole lot of the broadcast coverage of the day or into the evening. I pretty much had CNN on in our newsroom, and we had Fox on another TV that we had to keep refreshing the internet stream, so sometimes it shut itself off if somebody wasn't actively refreshing the computer. Tell me what you saw last night. Tell me how the pundits played into it. Tell me who won the TV battle, if there was one.
I'll put it this way. You know, when it comes to the pundits, mm-hmm. I'm talking about for the entire election, yeah. If we had more reporters reporting and less pundits talking, mm-hmm. This may be we may have a different outcome here. We had way too many people talking to each other about things that they didn't know than actually out reporting and talking to people about what mattered to them.
I don't know if we'd have a different outcome, but we might understand it better if we had more journalists there. You know, I watched 5 different television channels just kind of running back and forth mm-hmm. last night just to get a sense of things. And I will say this much, there was far less punditry than I expected. Because early on, I mean, the vote was just so shocking and so close in so many states that most of them, especially John King with the, you know, magic wall, and I spent a whole lot of time breaking down the votes. And that was probably useful. When it gets to the pundits, though, it's the same people, and you know what they're going to say before a single word comes out of their mouth, and we could spend a whole lot more time away from that, and as Ernest said, focusing on journalism. I would criticize all sides in this, but you know, here's Corey Lewandowski, who was being paid for a long time, you know, while he was also working for Trump. There were similar
Donna Brazile.
Okay, right? I will say this much, though. One punditry moment where I surprisingly found myself agreeing with Corey Lewandowski was at the very end. I mean, it was, you know, like 2:00 in the morning, and the folks on the Clinton side who were on the punditry panel on CNN were making all sorts of excuses for why Hillary Clinton should not have to come out and concede. And he was calling that out as being hypocrisy mm-hmm. because everybody was focusing on whether Trump would do that. Well, when Clinton had the opportunity to come out at that time and concede, she did not do so. And nobody on the panel was trying to criticize that decision other than lone little Corey Lewandowski. Now, Hillary Clinton did come out this morning, and she did give a concession speech that was very conciliatory and did all the right things. But I thought that was one punditry moment where maybe he earned a tiny little bit of his paycheck.
Okay, well, we've talked a lot about the top of the ticket. There were a lot of other races that were going on. We have a new governor-elect here in the state of Missouri, Roy Blunt, reelected to the Senate. Let's talk about some of the other races, too, that could potentially even have a larger impact on our lives.
Well, I go back to what I said at the beginning of the show,
yeah.
which is, you know, you had people showing up in this election who had never voted before. And when that happens, they generally vote straight ticket.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's what happened in the state elections. I think those people showed up to vote for Trump, and they just kept going Republican all the way down the line. And because when you look at... Yeah, I think the state polls, the local polls, I think they were, you know, they were wrong, but they weren't that wrong. Those races tightened considerably in the last week or two. And so I wasn't really too surprised by Greitens winning his race. I wasn't surprised that Kander was as close as he was. I didn't think he would win, and of course he didn't. But that race was a lot tighter. But when you have people showing up for the first time to vote, and they're voting for the top of the ticket, they're gonna go. Most of the time, they're gonna go straight down the ticket.
So again, journalists, pundits, pollsters were saying that Trump wasn't going to have coattails.
Yep.
He had coattails. I mean, it was a complete wipeout of the Democrats who were on the ticket in Missouri, and that says something about how difficult it's going to be for the Democratic Party with these sort of young stars, you know, like Jason Kander. They don't have a platform, you know, to jump off and campaign from at the moment. But I also thought it was really interesting, and we talked about this with our live. Session down at the Jefferson City Library the other week, and there was no focus in the reporting on the amendments. And look at what happened last night. And it isn't all predicted by Republicans coming out and trouncing everybody else. I mean, the parks and conservation tax extended. Missourians agree that that's a good thing, and they did it. Campaign finance limits were reinstalled by the voters of Missouri. Kind of surprising. The cigarette taxes, both of those efforts, they failed. There will be no new taxes, apparently, now with this constitutional amendment that can ever be, raised by local governments on services and transactions.
Right.
And that could have a huge, impact on governments going forward. And we approved photo voter IDs. So voters were all over the place if you were trying to evaluate it from a partisan basis.
Mm-hmm.
Missourians were taking a look at those amendments either out of a lack of knowledge or maybe even more
thoughtful
approach than we would give them credit for.
But I would say that they did it from a knowledge base, because one of the things I could say about the people who were supporting or either for or against those amendments, they did their homework, they got out, they put the information out there. I think people, they either got it on television or they got it in the newspaper, they got it online. I mean, they got it in flyers, it was doorknobs. I mean, there was a lot of information on those amendments. So I think when it comes to that, people were informed. But when you start talking about the actual races themselves, I think, you know, to me, it was people voting pretty much straight ticket
the way down. Well, we've done a lot of looking back. Let's look forward. Let's look to the future. What do you expect? What do you see happening with a president-elect Trump, a President Trump, his relationship with the media? There was a time he called us all scum. And how does that relationship look to you going forward?
I don't know. I really don't know. He's so unpredictable mm-hmm. when it comes to the media. It's what's going to be interesting is he woke up this morning as the president-elect of the United States of America. And now he's going to have to figure out, what does that job mean? And how do I do this job? Because in his previous job, he could just go off and fire people. Well, as the president of the United States, you can't really just go off and fire folk at will. You know, they're political appointments you can fire, but other folks are protected by civil service. So now... we will see whether or not he can govern. He can campaign. He can be on television. He can give great speeches. But can he govern?
It's worrisome because the things he has said mm-hmm. during the campaign about the news media and wanting to rein them in and calling them biased and singling out individual reporters for torment. I mean, all those things are troublesome.
Yeah.
If you believe that he is going to carry through with the things he said as president. And I don't know how to read that. I don't think anybody knows how to read that. A lot of people would like to believe that based on what he said last night and his acceptance speech, that he's ready to move forward. He realizes being a president involves compromise and getting things done. And maybe that is the true Donald Trump. Maybe this a lot of this stuff was just show or a strategy to get himself elected. But maybe not. I wouldn't bet that the things he said he didn't mean. We just don't know yet.
And the other interesting thing is going to be the media's coverage of the Republican Party, because now he's the leader of the Republican Party. Mm-hmm. What happens to Paul Ryan? What happens to Mitch McConnell? He said a lot of bad things about them during this election, and now he's going to have to work with them if anything is going to get passed. I mean, we had some of this during Bill Clinton's first term. We had some of this during Barack Obama's first term in terms of working with Congress. Even when you are in control, you still have to work with them. And how does the media going to cover that?
I think, too, that the media, the news media have a lot of soul searching to do. I mean, and I think first that starts with being a little humble. For example, the American Society of News Editors put out a statement today, and it wasn't terribly humble. It was basically saying, we're going to stick up for the rights of the First Amendment and freedom of the press. And it really didn't say, well, you know that we need to look and see how we can do better, but we need to do better. We're an institution, like a whole lot of other institutions, that large swaths of the public do not trust. And we have to do something to rebuild that trust, not just blame Trump or blame low information voters or blame the economy or whatever. We have to look inside and say, what are we going to do to regain the trust of people who don't trust us anymore?
No, I mean, you're absolutely right, because right now, the media is not trusted by conservatives. They're not trusted by liberals. They're not trusted by progressives. No one is in the media's corner. So they're going to have to build that up. And the only way you can do that is to actually get out and talk to people and tell their stories from their lived experiences and not sit in the echo chamber and talk to the punditry.
Is that your challenge to the
That's
news
my
media?
Challenge. That's my challenge.
Okay. Well, that's something we're going to have to be watching and looking for in the coming weeks, months, years.
Yes. And maybe one way we can do that is more diverse sources to our news stories. And I mean, when I mean diverse, I mean really diverse, including the people who feel like they were neglected or stereotyped or part of a very simplistic narrative. We've got to incorporate them into our reporting, too.
Okay. Well, that music means we're pretty much out of time for this week. I'd like to thank you for spending the last half hour with us. You can read more about what we talked about today. You can watch or listen to our program again under the Programs tab at KBIA.org. Like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. Our handle there is at Views on KBIA. We will be back with you again next week. I'd like to thank Travis McMillan from RJI for directing today's show, and to Pat Akers for handling the audio. Megan Sheets is our associate producer, and I'm Amy Simons. Again, from Mike McKean and Ernest Perry, we'll be with you again next Wednesday for another edition of Views of the News.